coming for so many days. Definitely it's your credit, and it's definitely your sincere desire to understand the truth of life. Steadiness in today's age is considered to be a disease. It's considered to be, you know, not fashionable, because, you know, today is an age of change, constant change. So people feel very comfortable when everything is new every time. But in this age, if somebody is able to have a steady determination to learn something, it's definitely laudable. So I would like to begin today's session first by revising what we discussed for the last 2 days. We'll have a quick revision and then we will go into session 3. Is everyone able to hear properly? The back, able to hear properly? Little louder? Hare Krishna. Yeah. So, day one, we discussed about the search for happiness, and we began day one by studying what are the common things between humans and animals. And we saw that there were four common things. The four common things are sleeping, eating, enjoying, and defending. And we saw that the differences between the humans and animals are A, ability for higher inquiry, B is bliss, C is making the right choices, and D is determination to follow the A, B, and C. And then we saw that for us to experience real happiness in our lives, we saw that there are problems, and we saw that there are relative problems and real problems. Relative problems means that one man's food is another man's poison, but they are relative in nature and they're temporary in nature. So easy to deal with. But the real problems are, the definition of real problem is, what are the three definitions? Common to all, nobody wants it, but nobody can avoid it. Wonderful. And what are the real problems? There are 7 in number: birth, old age, disease, death, and adi atmik, which is problems of the body and mind, adi bhautik, the problems caused by other living entities, and adi daivik, which are problems caused by natural disasters. And then we also saw that to solve the real problems, the world is offering us temporary solutions. There are 3 temporary solutions that are offered to us. What is the first one? Scientific advancement and sense gratification. So many things are offered to us saying that forget the problem, problem doesn't exist. And the second solution is speculation, and we saw so many varieties of speculation. And then the third solution is superstitious religious rituals. These are temporary solutions. So what is a permanent solution? Then we saw the story of the millionaire father who lost his son, and then we saw that the real solution is if the son can be connected back to his father. And then we also finished our discussion by saying that we are trying to search for the right thing, which is happiness, but in the wrong place. The wrong place is this world, which is called as Dukkhalaya, which is a place of misery. And then we saw that the permanent solution is actually connection to God. And then we, day two, we discussed about whether that God really exists or no. And we saw first proof for the existence of God. We saw 4 proofs. What is the first one? Creation implies a creator. The second one is laws imply a lawmaker. What is the third one? Organization and order. And what is the fourth one? Design implies an intelligent designer. And then we saw 2 definitions of God. What is the first definition of God? Supreme source of everything, supreme proprietor, supreme enjoyer, and supreme controller. So these are 4 definitions. And then we also saw there's another definition of God, which is Bhagavan. What is meaning of Bhaga? Bhaga means opulences. And there are 6 opulences. If anyone has these 6 opulences in completeness, that person is God. And we saw these 6 opulences. What are the 6 opulences? The first opulence is wealth. The second one is strength. Third is beauty. Fourth is knowledge. Fifth is fame. And the sixth one is renunciation. So So if anyone has all these six qualities in completeness, that person can be considered to be Bhagavan. Yeah. So the difference between fame and renunciation, because they look similar to some extent, but of course, I'll tell you the essential difference. Somebody who is famous generally is very proud, can be proud. But somebody who is renounced, the natural quality of renunciation is humility. And somebody who is renounced, he may have unlimited, but he knows that he can serve in a better way if he renounces. And the most important thing in these six opulences is that if anyone has even one of these opulences, that person becomes very attractive to the eyes of the world. You will find, you know, somebody who is very wealthy. Wealth, strength, beauty is very easy. Even to some extent, knowledge is very easy to understand. But of course, and even fame to a great extent. But renunciation is also a quality that attracts. Because you always find that anybody who has given up something wonderful for a very special cause, that person becomes attractive to the eyes of the world. Mother Teresa. Why is she attractive? Is she beautiful? Is she wealthy? Is she, you know, extremely knowledgeable? She's a simple lady. Why is she attractive? Because the quality of renunciation is a lot exhibited. Mahatma Gandhi. Why is he attractive? The prominent quality is the quality of renunciation, which is makes a person attractive. So if anyone exhibits these six qualities in completeness, not partial, completeness, that person is considered to be God. So these are the two definitions of what God is, who God is. And then we also saw that, you know, can I see God? We discussed this. We saw that how the unseen can be proven by the seen. And then we saw the theory of cause and effect, of how every cause, you know, can be understood by the effect it is producing. So like just like a fan which is working, you can know that there is electricity, therefore the fan is working. So every cause has an effect. So similarly, when you see creation, and then you see the style of working, which is so perfect and so orderly, then you know the effect, the cause is due to somebody who is monitoring and controlling. And then we also saw that there are three methods of acquiring knowledge about anything in this world. What is the first method? Pratyaksha Praman. Pratyaksha means sense perception. By seeing, hearing, you know, these are the ways in which you can acquire knowledge. But we saw that Pratyaksha Praman is a very defective way of acquiring knowledge. I gave four reasons why Pratyaksha Praman is defective. Does anybody remember? Because all of us, we, Pratyaksha Praman depends on senses. And our senses have four defects. What are the four defects? The first defect of the senses is they are imperfect. The second defect is that they have a tendency to be illusioned. The third defect is that, what is that? Make mistakes. We have a tendency to commit mistakes. And the fourth defect is we have a propensity to cheat. So because everyone is imperfect in his senses, naturally he gets illusion. You know, he gets illusion because of imperfection in senses. And because he gets illusioned, he commits mistakes. And because he commits mistakes and he has an ego involved, he tends to cheat to cover up those mistakes. And then we saw, therefore, Pratyaksha Praman is not a perfect way of gaining knowledge. I gave an example of Pratyaksha Praman. What is an example? I gave many examples. Some of the examples are like, for example, you know, your ability to see. You cannot see beyond the infrared visible spectrum. Hearing has a certain ability. Like that, every sense has certain ability. What if God is beyond these, our dimensions? We cannot see God. We can only see till a third dimension. We can only see 3D. What if God is on a fourth dimension? We can never see, even if he is right now and present in front of us, right? So therefore, we saw that Pratyaksha Praman is an imperfect way of understanding God, acquiring knowledge about God. Then we saw second one was Anuman Praman. Anuman Praman means guesswork. So Anuman means you are speculating, trying to understand through your own imagination and through your own ability to think. What is the example I gave for Anuman Praman? Huh? Somebody said that. I gave the example of six blind men trying to understand what an elephant is. right? So each one is speculating and trying to understand his own way. He never comes to a conclusion. And I also spoke about how, you know, if somebody just uses his imagination and thinks what the reality is, it need not be the reality, because imagination and, you know, speculation can go wrong all the time. And then I spoke about a third way of acquiring knowledge, which is called as Shabda Praman. Shabda Praman means the word of authority. And the weight of the word of authority is more powerful than any of the other three. We will discuss something more about Shabda Praman today also. And then we saw how if you take guidance from the right authority, it's not that you just listen to anyone and everyone, but the right authority, that is the most important thing. Then you get perfect knowledge. And then we saw that the scriptures are the written word of God, which are the authoritative sources of acquiring knowledge about God. So now we also discussed why we should put faith in the scriptures. I gave three reasons. The first reason is historical evidences. In that, what examples I gave? Bhugol. Earth is round. This is something that has always been spoken in the scriptures, and we didn't need to speculate and, you know, imagine or kind of do some research. It is always written, and because it is written, it is the truth definitely. And even if you go to verify that truth, you will come to the same conclusion. So there is something called research. Research means searching for something that is already existing, right? So research in certain fields is not necessary, and it's a waste of time. You can do it, but you should be rest assured that it's a waste of time. So there are certain things that are already well defined in the scriptures where research is not needed. And just like, for example, whether life exists in plants. This is something that science has been researching for quite some time. But the scriptures have always been mentioning it. So therefore, that research was, in one sense, redundant. So again, I gave many other examples, like for example, cow dung. Antiseptic properties of cow dung, which is what always has been spoken in the scriptures. Then we also spoke about the development of the embryo, which is written in the Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto. So like that, we can give many examples of how historical evidences have proved the scriptures to be truth. And of course, you know, yeah. Then the second reason is instruction manual. The scriptures are like an instruction manual. Just like with every machine, you get a manual to understand the machine better. So scriptures are like instruction manual for the human body to understand how to make best use of this facility. And then finally, the last reason is predictions. There are many predictions written in the scriptures, which are written thousands of years back, which are now proven to be true. For example, the existence of Chanakya Pandit, or King Ashok, or Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, or Gautam Buddha. So many of the predictions have already been there. And that's how we have faith in the scriptures. Now, I will discuss a little more about why we should have faith in the scriptures. This will give us some more logical understanding. And why I'm spending some more time on this aspect is because from now onwards, whatever I will speak, I'm going to speak based on the scriptures. Therefore, we need to have this fundamental clear that why we need to have faith in the scriptures. Now I'm going to ask you all a very simple question. If a child wants to know who her father is, what should she do? DNA test. Okay. What else? What is the other way? Ask her mother. Any other way? Is there any other way? Believe in the father. Okay. So now, let us assume that we do genetic testing, which is a very logical scientific method. It is explained that we're just assuming that just 10% of the males on this planet, we are just calculating and testing only those. It comes to about 250 million males. And then you assume 100 seconds per male to test. It's very difficult in 100 seconds. Assume it will take about 800 years of non-stop testing. And that too, first of all, after 800 years, you will get about 1,000 people who are almost similar. First of all, who will live for 800 years? The person who wants to test also is dead. And 10 generations after him also is dead. The father is definitely dead. So what will you achieve by doing a DNA testing? So DNA testing is nothing but Pratyaksha Anuman Praman. Pratyaksha Praman means unless I see, I will not believe. So if somebody wants to know who is his father, and he says, I will not believe unless I have a proof. This is what it takes. There is no way but except to have faith in the words of the mother. And that is Shabda Praman. And the faith in the words of the mother, you know, the word of the mother is more powerful and more authoritative and has a greater weight than 800 years of genetic testing. That's the power of authority. That's the power of words. That's the power of Shabda. So now somebody might say that how can I believe? But the point is, what other option is there? If you have another option, then you can argue about this one, right? But if there is no other logical and, you know, systematic and a time testing option, a fast option, then better to believe in this, right? And faith is an integral part of life. You cannot avoid it. I'm going to just give you some examples of how our life is based on faith. When somebody goes to a saloon to cut his hair, he sits on the chair and surrenders his head to the barber. The barber has a knife with him. The barber has, you know, the most sharp items with him. And you don't know the barber. Have you seen his driving license? Have you, you know, tested his criminal records? No. You go in and sit, and most of the times go to sleep. Right? We have such an amount of faith that this person is not going to do any harm to me. How is it possible? Why do we do it? Because without faith, we cannot exist practically. When you enter into an aircraft, do you go to a pilot and ask him, show me a license? How many flights you have flown till now? How many crash landings? You know, you never do that. You go inside, sit, and go to sleep. Why? Faith. So faith is practically an integral part of life, and at every point, we need to have faith. You go to a doctor, you go for an operation. Do you ask the doctor for his medical certificate? Do you go and start testing, you know, how many patients he has killed, how many patients he has, you know, saved? Never do it, right? Why? We have faith. I'm coming to the right source, I'm coming to the right hospital, and I have faith that this person will do the best for me. So faith is an integral part of life, and it's explained that the scriptures are like our mother, and God is like our father. If you want to know who our father is, the best way is ask the mother. And there may be other ways, but the authority of the mother is more powerful than the authority of any other manner. Therefore, we need to have faith in the scriptures. So as I was telling yesterday, that for every subject in this world, you need a book, which is the authority in that field. So similarly, in the field of understanding who God is, the authoritative book is the scriptures. And that is why we consider Shabda Praman as the authority in understanding about God. Now, before we understand anything more further, we need to first understand who we are. We have spent sufficient amount of time understanding, you know, whether God exists or no, and so many other things. But let us now go deeper and understand who we really are. Essentially, everyone knows unlimitedly about the world in general. Today's time is a time of information. Too much data. But then, let us try to understand how much we know about ourselves, right? The most important person for ourselves, at least, is ourselves, right? Today's this generation is called as the I generation. Everyone is selfish, only wants to know about himself. But actually the fact is, no one knows anything about himself, right? So therefore, we are going to spend one whole day trying to understand ourselves. Probably you might have never come across, you know, some setup where this is actually some called personality development. If you want to know what is personality development, this is what it is. Unless you know who the person is, what will you develop, right? So let us try to understand who we are and try to focus on that. So the first question is, what is birth? Where do we come from? You know, birthday is something that everybody likes to celebrate. But why is a certain child born in a certain place and with a certain parents and a certain, you know, manner in which he is born? And at the point of death, where do we go from there? So these are questions that hardly anybody is trying to address or even trying to think about, right? So today, let us try to think in these terms. Where are we come from and where are we going to? And right now, who are we? Another interesting thing that we will also discuss is life after death. Is it a fact or is it a fiction? And therefore, unless we know what life is, who we are, we cannot answer any of these questions in toto. So now, let us spend some time to think who we are. Now I'm going to tell you something very interesting. I'm going to ask you a question after I tell you some things, and then you need to introspect. And just for, you know, the benefit of actually being able to understand this and be most benefit from this session, you need to think from application point of view, not from a theoretical point of view, right? Because all this we're discussing is not about some other person. You know, we're discussing about ourselves. So since we're discussing about ourselves, we have to be ready to apply everything we discuss in our lives. Only then our discussions will be really meaningful and effective. Now, is there any identity in our lives which is a permanent identity? Like, for example, I'll give you. All of us, when we are asked to identify ourselves, we produce a card or we tell our, you know, name, so and so. So let us just take all the roles and all the identities that we are connected to in this world. Okay, so anybody can just name the different identities we are connected to. I'll give you an example. You know, when somebody asks me, who am I? I tell, my name is Shubho Vilas Das. Now, that is an identity. I have a name. Now, you can tell me, what other identities all of us are connected to? Mother, father, like that. Teacher, anything else? Qualification, you know, engineer, doctor, lawyer, yeah. Anything else? What we do? Yes. Anything else? Work we do, yeah. The designation, yeah. Very important. What else? I'm an owner of this and this. Yeah, very important. What else? Staying at residence. What other identities we connect ourselves to?
Father, mother,
yes.
Race, gotra.
Race, gotra, yeah. Religion, nationality, right? We also connect as human beings, yeah? So many connections. Now, I'm going to ask you, you know, gender, of course. So many, I'm going to ask you now some questions, introspect. Are any of these identities that you have mentioned, are they permanent identities? First, is name permanent? No, name can change anytime, right? And is the name actually connecting to the person actually? You know, like for example, there are so many names. Like, you know, there's one person whose name may be Lakshmipati, but he may be a beggar in the Dadar footbridge, right? Somebody might be Nayan Sukh, his name, but he might be a blind person. So the name doesn't identify with the person. And plus, the identity can also change, right? If I have the name so and so, tomorrow I can get another name. I can change everywhere in my passport, visa, everywhere I can change my name, right? That's not the permanent identity. What else? What about the role of being a wife or a husband? Can that change? 100% it can change. Today is a world of divorce all the time. Lost connections. What about the role of being a father and mother? Can that change? Yes, it can change. Somebody can be adopted by somebody else. Somebody else can be the father, mother. And of course, at the point of death, the role changes completely. What about the nationality? Can it change? 100% it can change. You can change your nationality. You can have dual nationality. So many things. What about the role of your qualification, educational qualification? Can it change? 100% it can change. You can change your, go into a different line. An engineer can become a lawyer can become a doctor, anything can happen, right? What about gender? 100% it can change. In Chicago, they have in the driving license, one of the columns says, have you ever had a sex change before? You're a tick. So that means it's happening so often, right? So even the gender can change. Now the question is, what is that identity that can never change? So therefore, we come to a point which is called as, we have, all of us have two identities which are very, very clear and distinct. One is called a relative or a temporary identity, and the second one is called a real and a permanent identity. The relative and temporary identity is guaranteed to change, but the permanent and the real identity is going to remain forever. Now I'm going to tell you a story, and then I'm going to ask you a question. There was a boy who had bought a brand new car, sports car, and after buying the car, he went and took it to his college. First day, you know, he took the car to his college. He was showing off, you know, everybody was impressed with the car. And this boy, he asked, one of his friends came and asked him, can I take a test drive? He said, no, I can't give you, this is too costly. So he said, please, just 10 minutes. So he said, okay. So this boy, he took the car and drove it. And after driving, a truck came and banged on the car. The car, and this boy was seeing from top. And he saw in front of his own eyes, his brand new car costing 90 lakhs, crushed by the truck. And this boy rushes down. And he sees that his friend is badly injured. And then he also sees that his car is badly bruised and dented and practically in a mess. Now, if you were that boy, and if it was your car, what would you do? Would you take your friend to the hospital, or would you take the car to the garage? Are you sure?
Yes.
Now I'm going to tell you something very interesting, which you all don't know. And then you tell me what you would do. There's a scientist, his name is Dr. Monson. And this man, he did a research one time. He took a human body and separated all the chemicals, all the ingredients of the human body. Totally separated it out. And then he, you know, held them in different containers. And then, after separating, you know, this is what he came up with. 5 pounds of calcium, 1.5 pounds of phosphate, so on and so forth. Mostly water. And then, he found out the market value of all these chemicals put together. And guess what? The amount came to rupees 110. So my question is, we are worth just rupees 110. And that car is worth rupees 90 lakhs. So if somebody has even a little bit of business sense, the greater investment is in the car. And the human body is just worth 110 rupees. Now, why would you take your friend to the hospital when he is worth only 110 rupees? The next question is, if I go to a mother and tell her that I want to buy your son and I'll give you 200 rupees, your son is worth only 110, but I am a little, you know, generous and I'll give you 200 rupees. Will a mother sell the son? Impossible. What if I give her 1 lakh rupees? Will she sell? Impossible. So the question is, are we really worth only 110 rupees? Because that's what science says. That's what the facts say. So now, what is that thing that makes us more valuable? So now, I'm going to show you all some pictures, and you have to guess the emotions in these pictures. What is this emotion? He's happy. What is this emotion? Frustrated. What is this emotion? Surprise, shock. What is this emotion? Affection, love. Now, the question is, if all of us are really a bag of chemicals, how can a bag of chemicals express such emotions? If it was possible, then why don't we put all the phosphate, calcium, this, that together in a sack and then expect love, expect, you know, frustration, expect happiness? Is it possible that you just put all the chemicals together and expect emotions? No. Now the question is, if this Dr. Monson is right in terms of separating all the chemicals out and selling them and finding the price of it, so what is that factor which makes us priceless? What is that factor which gives us emotions? What is that factor which cannot be reproduced in society today? If it was possible, then why we are not able to combine all these chemicals together and produce another living, you know, happy or a sad human being? That is the crux of the whole issue. Therefore, if we are, you know, if you're not able to understand this matter, this much, then what is our true essential identity? That is what we need to understand. Therefore, the scriptures say that I am not the temporary body, but I am an eternal soul. Now, this brings a lot of questions in our mind, I know that, and we will answer all these questions. I am talking about an identity of ours which is separate from the body. That means this is an identity which is an eternal identity, which is not going to die when the body dies, and which is the one that is actually animating the whole body, which is the one that is actually giving us all the emotions, and which is the one that is priceless. When the mother or the father or anybody loves the other person, we are not loving the body. What we are loving is a person who is residing within the body. That is the soul, Atma. And, you know, it is called by different religions or in different ways. But that is an identity that never changes. Your external body may change. Your name may change. Your nationality may change. Your color of your hair may change. Your hair may fall off. Your skin color might change. You can change your gender. You can change your profession. You can change your religion. But what you cannot change is the fact that you are an eternal soul. That is an identification that goes with you forever. And at the point of death also, it carries forward. I am right now not discussing logically. I'm going to discuss logically now onwards, right? We will prove how we can understand that the soul exists. And we'll also talk about, you know, what happens after death. But this is essentially what we are. Now I'm going to tell you a story. One time, a young boy, saw his grandmother writing something with a pencil. And he asked her that, "What are you writing?" So she told him, "I am writing some instructions for you with the help of this pencil." And the grandmother told him that this is what the pencil has taught me. So now I am going to, you know, try to understand and relate how we are very much similar to a pencil, right? Pencil is something most insignificant which we hardly see and, you know, understand the value of. But if you study the life of a pencil, the pencil can teach us some really powerful lessons, which is what will reveal to us our true identity and true nature. The first thing that the pencil teaches us, that the essence of who we are lies within us. The pencil, you know, the color of the pencil externally, you know, it may be red, it may be white, it may be black, it may be whatever color. But what is the most important part of the pencil? The lead within the pencil. And the lead determines the effectivity of the pencil. You cannot write with the pencil unless the lead has come out, right? So externally, a lot of things have to be removed for the lead to come out. And then the pencil becomes useful. So the essence of the pencil is within the pencil, not outside the pencil, right? So similarly, all of us, the essence of who we are is within us. And externally, we have a coating, we have a covering, we have a layer, which is outside of us. But essentially, who we are is within us. And people in this world praise us, appreciate us, or glorify us for our achievements. But all this appreciation, glorification, and on this praise is based on the external identification of who we are. Nobody really sees us, right? So externally, people, you know, can relate to us much more. But the problem is, when we identify ourselves only with the externals, we can never truly become happy. Because what we are, who we are, is something that we are on an internal level. Internally, we are something else, and externally, we have a covering. But unfortunately, people love the external, but have forgotten the internal. And therefore, because people love the external and forgotten the internal, as a result, what happens is that the focus and the attention and the whole agenda is how to make the external happy. How to keep the external sophisticated. How to keep the external polished, but forgetting what or who we really are on an internal level. So therefore, the first thing that the pencil teaches us, that focus on the permanent, unchanging identity which is within us. And if we can live our life based on the internal identity, which is our real true nature, which is our real true identity, then we can be rest assured that we'll be happy and satisfied in life. This is the first thing that the pencil teaches us. The second thing that the pencil teaches us is that once it is sharpened and the lead is out, even if you scratch, even if you just, you know, shake the pencil a little bit, it leaves a mark. It leaves an, you know, impact. So this pencil is teaching us that we are playing so many temporary roles in this world. You know, the role of a mother, the role of a father, the role of a sister, the role of a husband, wife, the role of a professional. So many roles we are playing in this world. And these roles are like an actor playing in a drama. Now suppose, and I'll tell you one very funny but a true incident. Of course, it's a little away from the topic, but it's very interesting. How one, if he identifies with the role which he's playing, you know, it can be dangerous, but also it is important to identify with the role to a certain extent. Especially if the role is connected to who we really are. There was one man who was a very, you know, thorough actor. He loved his profession and he loved to act. And he would just absorb himself in the emotions of the role in which he's playing. So, one time he had a role of the character of Hiranyakashipu. Sorry, the character of Narasingadev. You know, there was a drama going on. And he had the role of Narasingadev. So he was acting. And while he was acting, he got so much involved in the role of being Narasingadev that he actually killed the person who was Hiranyakashipu. You know, live on stage. You know, he killed him. And then people asked him, why did you kill this person? He said, I just completely got involved and I'm sorry, I didn't know. Of course, then after that, a lot of things happened and then, you know, he was released. But then he played another role another time. And he played the role of Dasharatha Maharaj. And while playing the role of Dasharatha Maharaj, when Lord Ram was leaving the kingdom and going to the forest, he actually died while playing the role. He actually died. So he got so absorbed in the role that he was playing that he was, you know, he didn't feel that he is somebody else, but he just got absorbed in that role. So many times, being absorbed in the role of who you are not can be deadly, right? So many times we identify ourselves as something that we are not. That can be dangerous for our lives. Like for example, one time, this is a story I heard. Our ex-Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru, he had gone to one mental asylum for a visit, you know. And in the mental asylum, he met one man, lunatic. So this man asked him a question. He said, "Who are you?" And Jawaharlal Nehru, he answered, "I'm the Prime Minister of the country." So he said, "Welcome. When I said that, they put me here." So he was a crazy man. And who is a crazy man? Crazy man is one who thinks that he is something else. Right? That's the definition of being crazy. So he identifies himself as something else. So in that sense, all of us are crazy. Why? We identify ourselves as the external body, which we are not. Right? So the pencil teaches us that understand your role, which is the permanent role, and focus on that. And when you focus on your role of who you really are, which is our eternal identity, our permanent identity, then that will help us to play the temporary roles also better. So if we know what is the permanent role of who we are, you know, as the spirit soul, which is our eternal identity, that will help us to play the temporary roles as a father, as a mother, as a wife or a husband, whatever it may be, better. Why? Because we're focusing on the most permanent aspect of our life rather than focusing on the temporary aspects of our life. So when the permanent is stable, then externally everything will become all right. The third instruction that the pencil gives us is that no pain, no gain. This is a sharpener. And it's very interesting that when the pencil is sharpened, what happens? It's a painful process. The sharpening process is a very painful process. But without sharpening the pencil, is it of any use? No. Therefore, if we want to identify or if we want to really come out in the most magnanimous way, if we want our within to come out, or if we want to focus on who we really are, which is the spirit soul, then we have to be ready to undergo the process of sharpening, which is the process of accepting a certain amount of discipline in our life. And when we accept a certain amount of discipline, that discipline will help us sharpen our focus. And then that will help us to rejuvenate and actually come to who we really are. Sorry for the picture. And the another thing that the pencil teaches us is that mistakes can be erased. So whatever the pencil does as mistakes, it can be erased with a rubber. Similarly, whatever we may have done in the past, maybe so many mistakes, it can be erased. But we need to focus on what is to be written next. And then finally, the pencil also teaches us that it is valuable only when it is in the hands of an expert. Therefore, if we actually want to be valuable in our lives, in the real sense, we need guidance. We need expert guidance. And if we don't have expert guidance, we may do a lot. But the value of that thing will only come when it is in the hands of an expert. So anybody can use a pencil. Right from a student, you know, a small 2-year-old child, to somebody who is, you know, in the JJ College of Fine Arts, right? But how he uses it and what comes out of it will depend on who you are and what hands you are in, right? Similarly, all of us are like this pencil who have the lead within. We're all spirit souls within our external covering of the body. But if you want to manifest that beautiful internal spirit soul, which is valuable, which is priceless, and which is the one that we are ready to do anything for, then we need to be in the hands of experts. That means we need to take the right guidance. So now what we will do from at this point of time is that we will try to focus on the proof for the existence of the soul. Unfortunately, in today's society, this fact is something that no one wants to really focus on, no one wants to really understand, no one feels it is important and relevant in today's society. Like one time, one of our leading sannyasis, he had gone to a printer in Bengal. We were doing some programs in Bengal. He had gone to a printer who was printing a lot of things for us. So in that printer shop, he found a question paper. You know, this is a question paper for probably the second standard, third standard children. And the question, there was one question which was in the question paper, which is very interesting. So he asked this printer, and of course, at that point of time, the school principal had come to pick up the question papers. So, you know, he spoke to the principal. And he saw that question. That question was, it was written in Bengali, Ki Amar Porichoy, which means, what is our identification? Who are we? So this person, you know, this devotee, he asked this principal, if somebody writes in this, you know, what do you expect people to write as answer to this question? So the principal said, you know, I expect to that somebody would write, if anybody writes, I am a child, I'm a girl, I'm a boy, I'm a student, I'm a son, or I'm a student in standard 5. If he writes all these things, then he gets full marks. So this devotee asked him, what if somebody writes, I am a Atma, I am a spirit soul? The principal said he gets 0. So that means, essentially the world is in a complete tangential understanding of who we really are and what we really need to focus on. But the scriptures are in a completely tangential world of who we really are. Now the question is, who is right? That's the question essentially. And therefore, we want solid proof. Just like yesterday, we had a discussion about proof for the existence of God. Let us try to understand some proofs for the existence of the soul. So I'm going to give 3 proofs for the existence of the soul. One is a logical proof. I'm going to give many logical understandings how we can understand we are the soul. Second, I'm going to give a scientific proof, some scientific proofs. And the third, I'm going to give a scriptural proof, what the scriptures say about who we are. The first thing is I'm going to give a logical proof of who we really are. First thing is something called as common sense. Common sense, you know, in today's world, somebody, you know, made a statement. He said, common sense is not common practice. So, unfortunately, you know, common sense is lacking to a great extent. But what we will do is let us try to prove the existence of the soul just using common sense and logic. So, when somebody dies in a family, what do we say? You know, what is the way we address? Huh? He is no more. Wo chale gaye. Swargvasi ho gaye. He passed away. So these are some things that we. Pura ho gaya. Okay. So now these are some things. Let us focus on one way. He passed away. Now, I am going to tell you about a situation where there is a relationship between a husband and a wife. They love each other and they stayed with each other for years together. And then at some point of time, the husband passes away. And the husband is there at home. His body is there at home. But he passed away. The question is, the person whom the wife loves is still lying there. Exactly looks the same size, same shape, same height, same everything. Now, why do we say he passed away? Now, if I tell the wife that, you know, this is your husband, why don't you stay with him over, you know, for the night in the same room? We lock it from outside. Is it possible for any person to stay even if you love that person? Is it possible? Absolutely. The wife will scream. She will not be able to tolerate staying there. Why? If the person whom she loved is there, why cannot she stay with that person for one night? She stayed all her life with him. So the question is, who passed away? The person who is dead or whom you identify with is lying there. Exactly, looks the same. What is the meaning of he passed away? So the Atma left. That is the logical understanding. Now I'll ask you one more question. What is the difference between a dead body and a live person? If I pinch a dead body, will the dead body react? But if I come and pinch a live person, will he react? Of course he'll react. And he might react badly. So, what is the difference? The difference is that there is something missing in the dead person which is there in the live person. That is consciousness. And consciousness is a symptom of the soul. When the dead body is lying, you know, the only thing that is missing is that there is no consciousness. And the consciousness is absent because of the absence of the soul. Now, I'm going to tell you one more logical understanding. Now, I need somebody to volunteer. Somebody can come in front? Yes, please come. So I'm going to ask him a couple of questions. So when I'm going to ask him questions, you know, all of y'all should put yourself in his shoes. Of course, all of y'all don't have shoes, but still, try to put yourself in his shoes. Okay? And think what you would say as the answer. Right? This is something that you have to really be introspective for. Then you'll understand what I'm trying to come to. So now I'm going to ask you some questions. Very tough questions. Okay? Probably the toughest you have heard. The first question is, show me your hand. Okay? This is a little easy one. I'll show you, ask a tougher question. Show me your head. Point out your head. Wonderful. Point out to your nose. Now point out to your body. This is the body. Now, I'm going to ask a very important question. This is the toughest one. Point out to yourself. Okay, thank you very much. Give him a good hand. Thank you. So now, I asked a very simple question. When I say that this is my body, and then I ask this question, point out to yourself. If you say, this is me, then you're pointing out to your body only again. Again, let me put the same thing in a different way. This is my pen. What is the meaning of this is my pen? It belongs to me. But an implied thing is that this pen and me are two different things. This pen belongs to me. So similarly, when I say, this is my hand, that means this hand and me are two different things. And if I say this is my body, that means the body and me are two different things. Right? That is introspection. So even if you can think at that level, that is a proof that we are different from the spirit soul. Another logical proof is again the proof of cause and effect. One day I saw a car and this car started zooming ahead, but then I was shocked. There was no driver in the car. At least I couldn't see one. And the car was going fast at full speed, and then somewhere it stopped. Then I went and saw. It was a left-hand drive. The driver was sitting on the other side. So the point is that a vehicle cannot move without a driver. Why? If I leave a vehicle parked in the parking lot for 365 days of the year, you think the vehicle has the ability to move out? No, it cannot move. Why? Driver is missing. Therefore, the body is dead matter. How much ever time the body is lying on the ground, it cannot move unless there is a driver within. And without the driver, the body is practically dysfunctional. Now, I'm going to show you all a video. It's a very interesting video. And it doesn't have sound, so you can just focus on the video. And you try to understand what is happening within the video. And then we'll discuss. Now, what did you understand from this video? Attachment. What else you understood? Huh? Obsession. Yes?
Little care is the soul.
Little care? Little kid is the soul. Okay. Okay. Body.
External.
Yeah. Right. Right. Wonderful. Anything else? So in this, the car is the body. Okay. Right. Yes, I will tell you a story which will make you understand this concept perfectly. There was an old lady. She had a parrot, yeah, beautiful parrot, which she loved it like anything. And then to keep the parrot, she got a golden cage, very beautiful golden cage, and she loved the cage very much. And then she kept the parrot inside the cage, and every day she would polish the cage just to make it look really beautiful. She would spend hours polishing the cage, hours polishing the cage. And then the parrot inside, he started shouting first. No food. And he started yelling. Still the lady was obsessed about the cage. And then eventually the parrot died. But the cage was beautiful. This is the story of all of us. Just like this man, he was obsessed about his car. Every human being, in fact, the world is training us to be obsessed about the way we look, obsessed about the externals, obsessed about the body. And to the extent that we are neglecting the parrot within, the soul within, the atma within, or the driver, which is actually driving this external car, which is the body. And when somebody is obsessed about only taking care of the external, then the result is that there is frustration. The result is that there is so much of anxiety and depression because of identifying oneself with what he or she is not. And neglecting the most important aspect of life. And just like the car needs fuel to run, the driver needs food to eat. So similarly, just like the body needs food to eat to keep itself alive and active, the soul also needs food. Just like the food of the car is petrol or diesel, the food of the driver is not petrol. You cannot feed the driver petrol. So similarly, the food of the body is something that we can feed, all the kind of food that we have. But the food for the soul is something different. The soul cannot be nourished with only an external food. It needs a different type of nourishment, which is missing in today's society. That leads to so much of depression and so much of anxiety. So the theory of the logical proof for the cause and effect is that if you understand the effect which is happening, then you understand the cause. So when you see the car which is moving, you understand there's a driver in it, within it. So similarly, when you see that the external body is functioning perfectly, you should understand there's a driver within the body which is actually running the machine. And the next is a scientific proof of the understanding of the proof for the existence of the soul. I'm going to give two scientific proofs. The first one is called as near-death experiences, NDEs. There is a scientist, his name is Dr. Michael Sebaum. This person has done studies about 300-400 cases on people who have had near-death experiences. You can Google Michael Sebaum and you'll find a lot of his case studies. And he has studied many cases of people who have just come to the verge of death, maybe a heart attack, maybe some kind of a stroke, and somehow they've recovered back. And he has studied their experiences. And somehow, of course, it doesn't happen in every case, but many of the cases, many people have narrated out-of-body experiences. Experience of being outside the body and watching themselves. Now, if somebody is on an operation table like just one, for example, one man, he was being operated and he was on the operation table with, you know, 10, 12 doctors around him, operating him. And he was on a general anesthesia, completely asleep, unconscious. But he claims much later that he has seen the whole operation taking place from top. Now, and of course, he substantiates it telling the procedure of how, who did what. Now, how can a person who is unconscious, sleeping on the table, narrate what is happening when he was unconscious? Unless he saw it himself. And the research has always proven that these people were perfectly right. There was one more person who claimed something very interesting. He had an attack. He had a heart attack at one point of time when he was in the hospital. And his experience is that he has, you know, he left his body from the hospital bed and he started flying upwards. And he also started claiming that I left the hospital through the window and I was traveling upwards along the wall of the hospital. The doctors, they said, you have gone crazy. And they wanted to send him to a psychiatrist. But then Michael Sebaum, he came to know about this case and he started investigating. And then when he investigated more deeply, he asked, you know, can you prove, you know, do you have any proper proof that you actually saw something from outside? He said, yes, I remember one thing which could be a proof. He said, when I was traveling outside the, you know, along the wall of the hospital, I saw in one of the parapets, you know, on the edge of the hospital, there was a shoe. There was a tennis shoe in one of the parapets. And then they started investigating. And to the great surprise, they actually found tennis shoe in such a corner that nobody from within could have seen it. And he was on bed. And he's not going to have the time to go and do a research where a tennis shoe is lying. So there are many such cases of people who have had near-death experiences and who have recounted and they have been studied and analyzed. And many of these cases, and most of the times, the consistency is there in the way in which they have experienced it. Almost on the verge of death, but somehow they have come back to life. It's one common factor. Another common factor is observing themselves from somewhere else. Another common factor is that, you know, the feeling of flying, the feeling of going upwards, the feeling of passing through some kind of a tube, you know, some of the things that have been commonly observed in many of such cases. So this is a very powerful proof of near-death experiences, which is a scientific proof, which is researched. Another proof for the existence of the soul is something called past life memories. There's a scientist called Dr. Ian Stevenson, and he has studied more than 2,000 cases of people who have had past life memories. And I'll tell you one. One of our devotees, he was giving a talk in some college about past life memories and near-death experience and things like that. And at some point of time when he was talking about past life memories, he was telling a story. Suddenly one student, one boy in the class, he put up his hand. He said, I want to tell something. I mean, so he was surprised. What does he want to say? He said that I am a live example of past life memory. He said, I was a research patient of Ian Stevenson. So this devotee was totally shocked. He said, come in the front. And this boy came in the front and he spoke to the whole audience about his experience. This boy's name is Deep Kapadia. He comes to our temple many, many times. And we do call him sometimes for the Journey of Self-Discovery course to give a live account of his experience. But I'll tell you his story in essence. This boy, he said, he was, when he was about 3 or 4 years old, you know, very, very small. When he was about 3 or 4 years old, he started speaking. He was born in a Gujarati family. He started speaking a different language. So his parents, they were, you know, surprised that what language is this? They couldn't... Some signal? It's not on. So they, this boy, he started speaking a different, maybe reduce the volume a little bit, sorry. So he started speaking a different language. He was speaking Rajasthani language. So his parents are not able to understand, you know, how did he come to know this language and why is he speaking it suddenly, just offhand. And he started saying that I was, you know, with this some kind of scripted thing he was saying, that I was a guard in Jaipur Palace. Sorry, not in Udaipur Palace. So his parents, they didn't know what it, whether to believe it or no, whether he was just fooling around or, but they understood there's something wrong. So they called his uncle. And his uncle said that what this boy is speaking is logically consistent. Some kind of consistency. And he's speaking something that we have never taught him. So let us verify. And somehow he knew about this Dr. Ian Stevenson. And he said, let us approach them. And they approached Dr. Ian Stevenson. And he decided to investigate the whole case. And there was another lady, Pasricha. So she also got another doctor. They got involved. And they both came and studied his case. And then they realized that, let us explore what he has to say. They took the whole family, along with this son, this child, to Udaipur. And as they were, you know, as the train was approaching Udaipur, he started naming stations, one after another. He started naming stations. And then, when the train reached Udaipur, he got down on his own, you know, 4-year-old child, got down on his own, and started walking. And everybody started following him. And he walked across the bridge, and he spoke to the Tangawala in a different language. And he was bargaining, you know. And they all sat in the Tanga, and they reached some place. And he got down and he started walking towards a house. And suddenly he got lost. He found a wall. And he was searching for something. You know. So they were thinking, what is he searching for? They asked him, what are you searching for? And he said, there was a door over here. So there's no door. So then they thought that he is now lost. And then they found out that actually there was a door here. And then they changed it. And then they put the door on the other side. And then when they entered, the family was about, you know, 20 people were there in that house. And this boy, he straight went to one young man. He was a 22-year-old man. He told him, he told his name. He said, you are my son. This is a 4-year-old boy. He's calling a 22-year-old man as his son. So that boy was shocked. The 22-year-old boy was shocked. He thought there's some fraud case going on here. He said, somebody's coming to cheat us, you know, naturally. So then he said, I will not believe you unless you tell me the name my father, only me and my father, you know, knew. This is kind of a pet name. So this boy told that name. So this boy got completely confused. So then he said that there is one more thing that only my father knows, not even anybody in our house knows. He said, my father had a gun because he was a guard in the Udaipur Palace. He had a gun. And he would keep the gun in a very secret place that nobody knows. If you can find that gun, then I'll believe. So this boy went up two flights of stairs, and he opened a cupboard. And within that cupboard, there was a small cabinet. He opened that cabinet, and within that cabinet, there was another key. He took that key, he went to another place, opened another door. And inside the door, there was a big, you know, museum of many, many things, many artifacts of the Udaipur Palace. And then the gun was found there. And that was, you know, the history was that this person, he was a guard in the Udaipur Palace, but he was killed by somebody, and unnaturally. And then, you know, he took his birth in Bombay. So now there are thousands of such cases. Now, logically, how is it possible if we are just the body? Right? How can somebody remember something of the past life if we are just the body? So this is another scientific proof of how we can say that the soul exists. And then, what does the scriptures say? The Bhagavad Gita, it says, there are two types of reincarnation. One is called as the internal reincarnation, and the second is called an external reincarnation. What is the meaning of internal reincarnation? The scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, it quotes a verse, which says, Dehinosmi yata dehe komaram yovanam jara, tata dehantara praptir dhiras tatrana muyati. It says that deha means the body. Dehinosmi yata dehe kaumaram. Kaumar means, you know, boyhood. Yovanam means youth. And jara means old age. Tata dehantara praptir deha antara. What does it mean of deha antara? That means at the time of death. Dhirastatrana muyati. This verse says that just like a person passes from boyhood to youth, from youth to old age, similarly at the point of death, you pass to another body. And a person who is dhira means a stable person, is not bewildered. Let us just analyze it. This is called internal reincarnation. It means that if I have a photograph of one of you all, you know, when you are a small child, and a photograph of one of you all when you are a youth, or then one when you are in your adult age, and then now. If you keep the four photographs in front of you, will you be able to recognize yourself as a small baby? Impossible. If I show it to somebody else, will that person be able to recognize? Impossible. But if you show it to a mother or a grandmother, 100% they'll recognize. Why? Because they have seen the phases of change. What does it mean? Science has analyzed that every person, every cell of his body changes every 7 years. That means every 7 years, you have a totally different body. Not even one cell is similar. Right? That means every 7 years, we are changing our body. Right? Similarly, at the point of death, we change our body. And then Bhagavad Gita also says that Vasamsa Jirnani Yata Vihaya, it says that just like a person who is wearing garments, when the garment becomes old and it becomes useless, you remove it and throw it out and wear a new garment. So similarly, when the body becomes useless for the soul to reside in, the soul rejects the body and takes a new body. Just like you change your shirt, the soul changes the body. That is the scriptural understanding of who we really are. And now the next question is, many people ask this question, can you show me the soul? Only then I will believe in the soul. And you know, what is the proof that the soul exists? Chanakya Pandit, he brings out a very beautiful quotation, which is an analogy. I'll explain to you what it is. He says, can you see ittar or fragrance in a rose? Can you see it? No, you cannot see it. But if you undergo a process, you can find the fragrance. Can you see oil in the oil seeds? You cannot see. But if you undergo a process, you will find it. Can you see fire in wood? You cannot see. But if the firewood has undergone a certain process, you will be able to see it. And similarly, can you see ghee in milk? You cannot see it. But again, a process. And can you see jaggery in sugarcane? You cannot see it. But if you're ready to follow a process, you will be able to see. So similarly, if somebody says, can you show me the soul? Are you ready to follow a process? And if you are ready to follow a process, you will be able to see the soul. You will be able to experience the soul. You will be able to understand the soul. Like one time, we were giving a talk in one college, and one student challenged us. He said that if you can show me the soul, then today itself, I am ready to come and join your temple. Everybody in the class started clapping, and you know. So everybody thought that, you know, what answer we'll give. So we asked him a very simple question. When you do a chemistry experiment, you want to test the acidity or alkalinity of a substance. What do you use? You use a litmus paper. If you want to test the measurement of a certain device in physics, you use a vernier calipers or you use a scale. If you want to find something microscopic, if you want to observe something microscopic, what do you use? Use a microscope. Now, the question is, you can also think about it. We asked him that, can you use the microscope to measure distances? Can you use the vernier calipers to test alkalinity or, you know, acidity? You cannot. Can you use a litmus paper to see a microorganism? You cannot. Every science has an apparatus and a procedure. And if you use the apparatus and use the procedure, follow the procedure, you will get the result. But if you say, I will use only this apparatus and only then, you know, and still I want to see the result, you cannot. Even in today's science, you cannot. What to speak of deeper sciences. So if you want to see the soul, you cannot use these eyes because they have a limitation. Therefore, we need to use a certain apparatus. We will explain what the apparatus is on the sixth day. And we also need to use a certain procedure. And if you are ready to use that apparatus and ready to follow the procedure, you will be able to see the soul. But we will not be able to show you the soul if you say, show me now. What to speak of the soul? You cannot even see an atom. You cannot say the atom doesn't exist. Just because you cannot see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Similarly, just because we cannot see the soul, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. How can you understand that an atom exists? How can you understand that the molecule exists? Because the effect it is producing. Similarly, how can you understand that the soul exists? Because of the effect it is producing. The consciousness is a symptom of the soul. So if we are ready to follow a process, we will be able to see the soul. Now, I'm going to go a little deeper. Okay? Now, you need to be very focused and attentive because we are going to understand where the soul is and, you know, the whole composition of the body. So it is explained that if you want to understand ourselves better, this is the scriptural understanding of who we are. It is explained that all of us, okay, I'm going to ask you another question before we go into this. How many bodies do we have? One. Anybody else? How many bodies do we have? Two. Two and a half. Anybody else? How many bodies do we have? What do you think? How many bodies we have? Three. Wonderful. One time one. Very practical. Okay. The scriptures say, pardon? Seven. Wow. It's a good one. The scriptures say that all of us have three bodies. One is called the gross body, which is what we all see. It is made up of earth, water, fire, air, and ether. This is the body that Dr. Monson calculated as rupees 110. This is the gross body. This is the most external appearance of who we are. And this is the appearance, or this is the body that the world identifies with. And this is the body that all of us think we are. When we said point out to the body, this is the body that we point out to. But now I'm going to tell you about two more bodies that the scientific world has absolutely no access to. The second body is called the subtle body. It is called the sukshma sharir. The gross body is called as sthula sharir. Sthula means gross, perceptible. And sukshma means subtle, imperceptible. This is made up of three elements: the mind, the intelligence, and the false ego. These are the three ingredients of the sthula sharir. Just like somebody wears a suit. Externally, what he is wearing is the suit. But within the suit, he has a kind of a three-piece. You know, it's a three-piece suit. There's an external suit, there's a middle layer, and then there is an inner layer, which is the soul or the atma, which is the spiritual body. So the external body is called the gross body or sthula sharir, which is made up of earth, water, fire, air, and ether. The middle layer is called the sukshma sharir or the subtle body, which is made up of mind, intelligence, and the false ego. And within that is the innermost body, which is the spiritual body, which is called as the atma or the spirit soul. So just like somebody would wear, you know, your hand is there. Now, over the hand, if I put latex gloves, which the doctors wear, you know, it just covers the hand straight. And over the latex gloves, if I wear a boxing gloves or if I wear a cricket gloves, it's similarly our body is composed. Externally, the boxing gloves or the cricket gloves is the gross body. Within that, the latex gloves is the subtle body. and within that the hand is the actual spiritual body or the Atma, and that is who we are. Now, to understand this much better, I'm going to explain with the help of a concept. Shvetasvatra Upanishad, one of the 108 Upanishads, gives an analogy to understand who we are. And this analogy is the analogy of a chariot body analogy, it's called. It is explained that just like if there's a chariot drawn by 5 horses, and the horses are in hands. So if the horses are in the are controlled by reins, and the reins is in the hand of a chariot driver, and there is a passenger sitting in the chariot. So the understanding, the comparison is that the 5 horses are like our 5 senses: the eyes, the ears, the nose, the mouth, and the touch. The reins, which is actually holding the horses, is the mind. And the reins are in the hands of a driver, which is the intelligence. And there is a passenger who's sitting in the chariot, that is the spirit soul or the Atma. And the whole chariot is the body, is a gross body. Just like if the chariot driver or if the horses are powerful, very powerful horses, and the chariot driver who's driving the horses is a very thin, person. So can he control the horses? Absolutely, he's helpless because the horses are powerful. And just imagine all the 5 horses are wild, drunk horses. All of them want to go in 5 different directions. What will happen? Chaos. The whole chariot will collapse. That is the situation in today's world. The eyes want to see beautiful objects. The ears want to hear beautiful music. The nose want to smell the most beautiful things. The tongue wants to taste the most beautiful things. And the touch want to experience a soft touch. 5 senses dragging in 5 different directions. Just like if you go into a movie theater. What do you go to a movie theater for? To see something beautiful. But then, if you only see something beautiful and you cannot hear, that's also not good. So you want to hear also something beautiful. But only if you hear and see, but you don't have a soft seat to sit on. That is not comfortable. You need a soft seat also. And if you are sitting in a soft seat, hearing and seeing something nice, it is really good if you can eat something nice also. You get popcorn. But then, 1,000 people sitting in a theater, it starts smelling. You have to put perfume also to make it pleasing. In one theater, all of us are trying to satisfy all the 5 senses. This is like 5 different horses on a wild rampage. You cannot control, right? And especially if the driver is not strong. If the intelligence is weak, then naturally the intelligence cannot control the mind. And the mind will not be able to control the horses. And then the passenger who is sitting, he will just go for a toss. That is the result why people experience depression, why people experience stress, why people experience anxiety. Because the 5 horses are absolutely uncontrolled. And the mind has no idea what to do. The intelligence is not strong because there is no reinforcement to the intelligence. And the soul is lost. It's completely unsatisfied. Let me give you another example just to make this point very solid. Of course, I'm not going to details of this because this can go for 2 hours, right? And this is what we will be doing when we do the advanced Gita course. We'll be discussing about mind management, how to manage. I'm not going to details of that. But just to make you understand how the body functions and how to understand that there is a subtle body existing, right? For that, I'll give you an example which will immediately make you understand. Just like if there is a student studying for his exam, and next day morning he has a very important paper which he has not prepared for. All his, the whole time he has just fooled around, done nothing, and next day morning paper is there, so he's really become serious. So he's studying vast portion but less time. He spent the whole morning studying. And by afternoon time, a dialogue starts within his existence. Something tells him from within, come on, too much. I'm completely frustrated. Stop studying. And then another voice starts speaking from within that person. It says, you are a fool. All this while you wasted, today study. Right? But the first voice, it says that, no, no, it's too much. The second voice, at least study for 2 more hours. Then pushes a little bit more, studies a little bit more. And then now it's 9 o'clock in the night. Again the voice starts. The first voice, it says, I cannot tolerate it anymore. Stop it. The second voice, it says, you have not even finished 3/4 of the portion. Lot is still remaining. The first voice says, I cannot tolerate anymore. Revolt, complete. So then the first voice says, it gives a suggestion. The second voice gives a suggestion. It says, okay, put an alarm. You have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And then, you know, so the first voice, are you understanding these voices that we come across all the time? The first voice is the voice of the mind. The second voice is the voice of the intelligence. Mind has the function of thinking, feeling, and willing. The intelligence has a function of discrimination and decision making. The intelligence is the one which gives direction. It gives you the right direction. But the mind is absorbed in emotions, happy in just doing what pleases the senses. But the intelligence doesn't bother so much about what pleases the senses, but it bothers about what is right, what is good. So then the mind says, okay, no problem. The mind gives the direction to the senses. Mind tells the senses, put the alarm. The eyes go and see where the alarm is. The hands pick up the alarm, turn it, and then jump to bed. Now, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. The alarm starts ringing. Tring, tring. And then again the voices start. What does the first voice say? Go back to sleep. And what does the second voice say? Get up immediately. And then you start dialogue again. The first voice says, at least give me 2 minutes more. The second voice says, no, you have to get up. And depending on whose voice, which voice you listen to, you either get up or you continue sleeping. This is the mind intelligence dialogue, which happens within every person. That means the subtle body does exist, right? So if you study like this, then you understand that though we cannot see it, though we cannot touch it, though we cannot feel it, but the perception is there. We're able to understand it, right? This is how we understand the existence of a subtle body. And now we are going to many questions that are right now in your mind. We know what questions are there. So we're trying to answer those questions before you can ask. So the first question is, does the soul have a form? The answer to this question is very simple. The soul has a form, and in fact, soul gives form to matter. Matter without a soul is formless. Just like the moment a person dies, the soul leaves the body starts crumbling, starts decaying. You don't find decay happening in a body where the soul is existing. But why does within moments of death the process of decay start? Why? When an apple is existing, you know, in full, the moment somebody bites into an apple, the decay process starts. Why? Because a soul has intervened in matter. So the moment matter, the soul leaves matter, or you know, interferes with matter, the matter starts taking certain shapes or losing certain shapes. Wood, which is in the form of a tree, does exist. But unless a soul, which is in the body of a carpenter, actually interferes with the wood, you cannot get a shape of a table. Right? So soul actually gives form to matter. And therefore, also, the soul has a form. Right? But in this world, the soul has a seed form. Very, very subtle form. We'll discuss the size of the soul later, then you'll understand better. So soul gives form to matter, and therefore, the soul is not formless. It does have a special form. Now the second question is, many people have this question, is the soul in everybody's body the same? You know, all of us are sitting here, we said we are spirit souls. That means, is your soul, my soul, all souls same? I'm going to ask you a very simple question. Tell me, you know, anybody can guess, what is in my mind right now? What I'm going to speak right now? Huh? She's saying, I'm going to speak that you are the soul. No, I'm going to say I'm the body. So the point is, you're understanding what I'm saying. The point is that you cannot understand what is in my mind. I cannot understand what is in your mind. Which proves that all of us are individual souls. We are not, you know, one soul or a collective soul. But we are all individuals. Therefore, each one has his own likes, dislikes, you know, interests, so many things. Because we are all individual. And the Bhagavad Gita, it says that we continue to exist individually. Even if there are two people who are twins having exactly the same body, still within them there are two different souls, right? Therefore, every body has an individual soul. So that is the understanding. This third thing is that, where does the soul reside? Now, and I ask this question, that where are you? We can't understand where we are, who we are, right? Now, the question is, where does the soul reside within the body? The answer is that the soul resides in the region of the heart. The soul resides within the region of the heart. Now, some intelligent person may ask this question, what happens when there is a heart transplant? Right? Obviously, what happens to the heart? Does it mean that the heart, when it's taken out, the soul also comes out along with it? It's like this. I'm sitting on a chair. If I get up, somebody takes off this chair and puts another chair and I sit back on it. What happens? Have I changed? No, the chair has changed. So the heart is the place where the soul sits. It's like a chair. And when the soul is residing within the heart, if the heart is replaced and another heart is put, the soul continues to remain the same, right? There is no change. And I'll tell you something more interesting. This is something somebody who is a doctor, you know, any doctors here? We have one, we have two, we have three. So doctors can verify, you know, what I'm saying. So one question, which is a fundamental question of the medical field, is that we have a heart and we know that the heart beats, and the heartbeat is what pumps blood into the whole system. And when the blood is being pumped into the whole system, is because the heart is beating in a certain, you know, momentum and a certain frequency. Now, where does the heart get the frequency from? The simple answer any medical practitioner can say is that it comes from the pacemaker, which is within the heart. The pacemaker can be replaced. It can give, you know, electrical signals, whatever, you know. But the point is, where does the pacemaker get its strength or signal from? That is a question which there is absolutely no answer, right? There is no answer in medical field, because the pacemaker gets its electrical signal from the soul, which is spiritual in nature. The moment a spirit soul enters into a body, that is the time when the heart starts beating, because the strength comes from the spiritual energy. And the moment the soul leaves the body, you can judge when the heart stops beating, which is actually the proof also that the soul resides in the region of the heart, right? And therefore, there are many things which cannot be explained, but can be explained if we understand and have faith of the existence of the soul. And of course, we cannot see it. But again, the same question is that there are many things that we cannot see. Can we see an atom? Just because atom we cannot see, it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. You can see the effect it's producing, right? Similarly, the soul resides in the region of the heart. So the next question is that, is the soul destroyed at the time of death? The answer is, the soul is eternal. There are three words to describe the soul. Just like I said that The gross body is made up of earth, water, fire, air, ether. The subtle body is made up of mind, intelligence, and the false ego. Similarly, the soul has three properties. It is Sat, Chit, and Ananda. Sat means it is eternal. It never dies. When the body dies, the soul continues to exist. It is Chit. Chit means it is full of knowledge. Full of knowledge. And third one is Ananda. Ananda means it is full of bliss. That is what we started with. We are searching for happiness all over the world, but happiness is the constitutional nature of the soul. The soul is by property happy. But unfortunately, because we do not identify with the soul and we continue to identify with the external material body, we cannot perceive the happiness that is within us, right? Therefore, the soul is eternal. It cannot be destroyed. It cannot be destroyed if somebody shoots the soul with a gun. It cannot be burnt by fire. It cannot be, you know, watered, or it cannot be contaminated by water. And the soul continues to exist even after the process of death. When the body dies, the soul leaves this body and enters into another body. Just like when a shirt or a dress is dirty, we change the dress and wear a new dress. So similarly, when the body is unfit for the soul to live in, it changes into another body which is more appropriate and fit. Now, another question is the soul same as God? But before we enter into this question, and I would like to say something about the previous question, some more doubt could have remained. When we say that the soul leaves this body and enters into another body, now what is that factor which determines which body the soul enters into? What happens at the time of death? Let us spend a few minutes trying to understand that. That's very important for us to understand. The subtle body comes out along with the soul. So that means essentially what is happening at the time of death is that the gross body is dying, is withering away. But the subtle body, the sukshma sharir, that means the mind, intelligence, and the ego travel along with the soul to the next body. What is the meaning of that? What it means is that, what is the mind, what is the property of the mind I said? Thinking, willing, and feeling. Mind is a storehouse of experiences. Mind is a storehouse of desires, of thoughts, of emotions. So the mind stores all these experiences within itself, right? And then at the time of death, it is explained by Krishna in the Gita, yam yam vapi smaran bhavam tam tam tejayate anta kalevaram. Krishna says that yam yam vapi smaran bhavam. He says, whatever a person remembers at the point of death, that determines his next life. So that means the desires a person carries at the point of death determines what body he will get in his next life. Right? That means if somebody has a strong desire to sleep unlimitedly, that's the strongest desire which he has at the time of death, then the body that is suitable to fulfill that desire is the body of a polar bear. 6 months continuous sleep. Human body cannot tolerate more than 8 hours, maximum 12 hours. Beyond that, your back starts paining, your head starts paining, so many problems. But the polar bear conducive for 6 months. If somebody has a strong desire to eat, you know, anything and everything, the human body is not meant like that. You know, we have one of our devotees who, you know, he was raised up in a Western culture. All his life he's eating pizzas. But then, you know, at some point of time, the doctor, his whole system got choked up. You know, and the doctor banned him from eating pizza anymore. So the human body cannot digest. But the body of a pig, ideal, can eat anything and get away with it, right? So similarly, different desires give different facilities and different bodies are made to fulfill those desires. Anyway, let me not go into details. But the point is that at the time of death, whatever is your strongest desire, you get a body which facilitates that desire. And that means, this proves, when I was speaking about the past life memories, how did this person remember his past life? Because the subtle body is carried along. And the subtle body, the mind, is the storehouse of all the thoughts, all the experiences, all the emotions. And that is carried along with the spirit soul, with the Atma. And therefore, the memory is there. Right? Make sense? And now the question again is, many people will ask, why do some people remember and some people don't? Right? You know, if past life memories were available for everyone, you know, why don't we just remember it? I'll tell you a story. This happened when I was studying in my engineering college. One day, I took the bike of one of my friends. I just went somewhere and came back. And I came back and I gave him the bike. And he sat on it, he drove off. He went straight and he took a right turn. And after that, I couldn't see him. But then, after about 10 minutes, somebody came running from there. And he said that this friend of ours has met with a massive accident. What had happened was that when he took the right turn, he was going at a great speed ahead. Suddenly, you know, some buffalo came, you know, crossing the road. And he tried to avoid the buffalo, so he went off that road. And he banged into a concrete wall, you know. And the bike banged, the whole wall broke because of the impact of the bang. And this person somersaulted and he landed on the other side. So when we reached there, he was sitting on the roadside. So we asked him, you know, how are you? Are you feeling okay? He said, what happened? So I said, you just met with an accident. He said, what accident? And then, you know, he kind of completely lost his memory. So we were scared that he has lost all his memory. So I asked him that, just to test, I asked him, how many subjects did you fail last semester? He said 4. So I realized he has not lost too much. So then I asked him, what is the last thing you remember? He said, the last thing I remember is that you gave me the bike. From that point till the point he was sitting on the road, he remembers nothing. Why? Because certain times the traumatic experiences are deleted from our memory. Why? For our good. Just imagine, he remembers the whole accident, the whole traumatic experience. How tough it is. Just imagine, we remembered who killed us last life. Just imagine, we remember what experiences we had gone through in our last life. How can we live, right? Why do some people have fear of heights? Why do some people have fear of blood? Why do some people have phobia of certain things? These are all experiences from the past. And God is kind enough to us that He deletes everything when we take up a new life. So that we can not be haunted by the trauma of the past and live the present happily. How can somebody celebrate a happy birthday when he knows that he has been killed by somebody? And what if that person happens to be his relative now? Right? So therefore, the nature's laws are arranged in such a way that certain things are made to facilitate us not delving into the past but thinking about the future. And why doesn't it happen to everybody? And why do some people only remember it? You know, again, that question comes up. Because those people serve as examples for us. And that is their service. And then generally, these memories don't last all lifelong. They remain only in the first few years of a person's life. Yes?
Let's say if you have a fear of heights and that's carried forward, what could that mean from your past life to now?
It could mean many things. That probably you had a fall in your previous life and that resulted in your death. Or probably it also could mean that, you know, certain bad experiences of certain heights remained badly etched in the memory, you know. So it could be so many things. So, anyway, so the point is that, you know, many people, when we talk about these concepts, they ask questions, you know, that, Prabhuji, can you tell me what I was exactly in my last life, you know. Can you tell me? My question is very simple. Just imagine that, you know, somebody has got malaria and he's admitted in the hospital, he's taking a treatment for malaria. So the person, he starts asking, which mosquito bit me? I want to find the mosquito that bit me. And I want to kill that mosquito. Is it sensible? No. It's absolutely not sensible. Why? Because now you have got malaria, treat it. And take precaution in the future. So therefore, you know, instead of delving in what happened in the past, you know, exactly what happened, you know, exactly why this happened and all that, let us now understand that we know it. Whatever happened in the past is something we have no control of. But let us make sure that our future is bright. That is what is the journey of self-realization. You know, the journey of self-discovery means that from now onwards, what we should do, that is what we should discuss. What has happened in the past is gone, right? So, of course, that also, the past, you know, also determines so many things in our, the present conditionings we have, the way we look, the way we, which family we are born in. So many things are determined by that. But I'm not going to get in that concept now because day 5 is meant for that concepts. Okay, that we will discuss. The next question that people have is that, is the soul same as God? This is an extremely important concept and extremely important that you understand this perfectly. The soul is same in quality but different in quantity. Just like an ocean, if you take the whole ocean and you take a drop from the ocean, the drop of water is exactly same as the ocean in quality. But in quantity, the drop is minute and the ocean is infinite. Similarly, God is huge, is infinite. But the soul or individual Atma is minute, fractional. How minute it is, I will tell you. But qualitatively, it is exactly same. What is the quality? Quality is that Sat, Chit and Ananda. That means even God is eternal, even God is full of knowledge, and even God is full of bliss. That is common between us and God. But what is not common is the quantity. We'll explain, understand these concepts better as we go ahead. The next question is, does the soul change with the changing body? So the soul is changeless. Only the body changes. You know, there was one church, and this church has a very interesting concept, the way in which this church is made. The church has beautiful, you know, artistic things put up, and all these artistic things are made up of bones of people. And many of the saints who have, you know, served in the church, their bones are displayed in very artistic ways. And there is a placard in that church which says, remember me as you pass by. As you are now, so once was I. And as I am now, you shall be. So be prepared to follow me. Which means that this is a warning that we are going to pass away. And just because we are passing away doesn't mean the soul is going to go away. The soul is changeless, but the body changes. And that is something that you cannot avoid. You cannot avoid the change of the body. You cannot prevent the body from changing. You cannot prevent the body from getting old. You cannot prevent the body from being diseased. You cannot prevent the body from dying. But what is eternal is a concept that we don't die. The spirit soul never dies. Because people are obsessed with the concept of the body, the attachment to the body is so strong, they're not ready to give up the body because they think that they are the body. And when somebody gets detached from the body, that person can live a very happy life because he understands that whatever is happening in terms of suffering is happening to the body. But I, as a soul, Atma, is unaffected. So the next question is, the soul is changeless. The next question is, what is the size of the soul? This is a very interesting concept. The scriptures provide the exact dimensions of the soul. The explanation is, I'm just going to take 5 minutes more. I hope it's okay. It says that if you take the tip of the hair, you know, if you take the tip of the hair and divide the tip of the hair into 100 parts, okay? I'm telling the dimensional size of the soul. If you divide the tip of the hair into 100 parts and the 100th part, you take it and divide it again into 100 parts. So that one part is the size of the soul. 1/10,000th the tip of the hair. That is the size of the soul. Now, to see an atom is practically impossible. And the soul is even more infinitesimal compared to the atom. That's small in size. How can you see it, even if you want to see it? Right? Therefore, this is the size of the soul. But very interesting. Every living entity has the same size of the soul. An ant has the soul which is 1/10,000 the tip of the hair. An elephant has the same size. A blue whale also has the same size. But just see the power of the soul. Such a small infinitesimal size is controlling a huge elephant body, controlling a huge whale body, controlling a huge human body. That shows that the power of the soul is not material power. It is a totally different dimension of power. It is spiritual power. And therefore, when a person dies, it is not possible to carry the dead body by one person. You need four people to carry a dead body. Why? Because the body is light as long as the soul is present within the body. The soul gives lightness to the body. The soul gives flexibility to the body. The soul gives beauty to the body. The soul gives the pleasing look to the body. But as soon as the soul leaves the body becomes rigid. The body becomes unflexible. The body becomes heavy because the soul is missing. So the soul has the power to give an experience which matter cannot give. Right? And that comes to the end of this session. Let us summarize and then your question. Okay? The first thing we started with is our identity. We said that we are not the body, but we are the spirit soul, Atma. And then we saw some proof, the logical proofs for understanding how we are the soul and not the body. Logic we saw, first proof is common sense. We said he passed away. He passed away means that somebody has passed away who is not there anymore. The soul has left. We saw about introspection, how we say that this is my hand, this is my body. Similarly, when we say this is my body, which means that the body and me are two different things. And then we saw the theory of cause and effect. We saw unless a driver is present in a car, the car cannot move. Similarly, unless the soul is present within the body cannot move. We saw the second proof is science. Two proofs we saw. Near-death experiences. We saw how Michael Sebaum has analyzed so many case studies of near-death experiences. People who have claimed to be seeing themselves from somewhere outside. And then we also saw past life memories. We saw the story of Deep Kapadia. We saw the story of Dr. Ian Stevenson's research of 2,000 cases of people who had past life memories. And we also saw how the scriptures talk about the existence of the soul. We saw how there is a internal reincarnation, which is through in the same life, we change bodies. Every 7 years, we're having a totally different body. And then we saw also an external reincarnation. At the time of death, we change a totally different body. And then we also saw that how to see the soul. We said just like in science, every science has a different way to see the same truth. Just like in chemistry, we have a litmus paper to test. We have vernier calipers in physics. We have microscope in biology. Similarly, if you want to see the soul, you need to follow a certain process and you need to use a certain apparatus. And then rest assured, you will be able to see the soul. And we saw that all of us have three bodies, the gross body, the sukshma sharir, the sthula sharir, yeah, which is made up of earth, water, fire, air and ether, and the sukshma sharir, which is made up of mind, intelligence and false ego. And then there is a spirit soul or the Atma, which is a spiritual body, which is Sat, Chit and Ananda. Eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. And then we finally saw the different FAQs of how we are actually the soul. So now we come to the end of the session. From here, we go to the next session, which is one God or many gods. I will develop, based on what we have discussed today, the concept of all of us being spirit souls or Atma, and even God being Atma or a soul, but he is Paramatma, or he is big, the super soul. And we will discuss now whether really one God exists, or there are many gods, or, you know, what is the confusion about, right? We also discuss about, you know, how suddenly people pop up and claim themselves to be God. What exactly is the mystery? We will discuss that tomorrow. So if anybody has any one or two quick questions, we can take up, and then we can break for dinner. You're saying something?
Lord Krishna called Abhimanyu soul, and Abhimanyu soul could not recognize his father Arjuna. How come his mind and subtle
okay,
body?
I'm not going into the story, but what I'm going into is essence. I will put the same thing in a different format. Many people have this question: does ghost exist? You know, many have this question: does ghost exist? And can somebody remain without a body? Or can you call the soul from another place? You know, so many people have these tantric things, you know. Understanding is very simple. The soul, Atma, which is residing within a body, when it leaves the body, it carries the subtle body along with it. And depending on its, you know, actions and its desires at the time of death, another body is arranged. But a certain amount of time, certain times, the soul is denied a body because of certain actions that it has performed while it was in the previous body. And that is the time when the soul is moving around without a gross body, but with the subtle body. The subtle body has mind, intelligence and ego, and the soul is powerful and is having a subtle body. But it cannot have a gross body because of certain reasons. We will discuss that later. But because it is not having a gross body, it cannot enjoy. Why? It needs gross body to enjoy. Therefore, such souls try to enter into other people's body and try to enjoy through their body. That is the concept of what a ghost is. But in essence, that means that the soul does exist outside the body, but it doesn't have facilities to enjoy itself as much as it has within the body. Of course, when it returns back to the spiritual world, it is completely by itself. But as long as it is in the material world, the subtle body goes along with the soul. The subtle body doesn't allow the soul to, you know, be independent. And only when you leave the material world, the subtle body is left behind.
No, my question is, Arjuna was distressed, but Abhimanyu soul...
Yeah, it's... Soul, yeah.
Yes. Getting the same feeling.
Yes.
Because he had forgotten everything.
Yes. So it's the same thing. Now, if... I am, you know, if someone dies at this point of time and he gets another body. Now, generally when a person is alive, he has a lot of affection towards his mother and father. Now, if that same person who was in that body is a spirit soul ultimately, if he takes another body, that person cannot identify his previous parents. Why? Because it will create confusions. Just imagine, you know, here is one set of parents. Here's another set of parents. Here's a previous life, one more set of parents. You get completely confused who you are, right? And therefore, the great devotees of the Lord who can see things as they are, they do not identify themselves with externals. Therefore, they do not get, there's no attachment. The concept of attachment is not there. Now, even if you attach to, you know, somebody connected to you, there is an attachment. Just like, I'll tell you an example. One time, Srila Prabhupada, the founder of ISKCON, he was going to one place and he saw a beautiful mansion which was an ISKCON temple, and that mansion had a very interesting kind of a structure. There was a tree which was kind of enveloping the mansion, you know, it was like almost embracing the mansion. So somebody showed Prabhupada, it was a very beautiful looking scene. He said, just see how beautiful this tree is. Prabhupada made a very nice statement. He said, this shows, you know, vision, how somebody can actually see beyond externals. He said, this person who is in the body of this tree, He must have been the owner of this house before. And he's attached to the house, now he's born as a tree. And he's embracing the house. You understand? So, even if you take a different body, because the attachments are there, because the mind is carried along. Na? So the attachments sometimes don't allow you to forget the past. But sometimes those who are self-realized, they do not get attached to the past. They understand these are just superficial connections which come and go. So that is the point probably you are trying to bring out, you know, which shows that ultimately we are the eternal spirit soul, which is the Son of God, which is connected to God, who is our Father. And here we have too many temporary fathers and mothers. Now, which father and mother we are identifying with is depending on the present condition. So that's how we should understand this. Make sense? Anybody else has one more question? Yes.
I have a quick question. I was wondering, do you believe that God performed miracles like in the during the battle of the Kurukshetra when God made the sun hide so that Karna could not kill Arjun? Do you believe that God,
Jayadrath.
Sorry. Yeah. So could not kill. So do you think that he performed those miracles? And you know, in the early 90s, there was this thing where there was this craze where Ganpati drank milk for one day. Do you believe that those things really happen? And does God really need to prove himself that way?
Yeah. So in essence, I will answer your question. These miracles prove something supernatural. So now I can substantially answer this question tomorrow, because right now I have not told you who God is. Right now I have not told you, you know, who all these personalities are. So if I go and tell you explanations why what happened, then there might be some confusions. So right now I wouldn't want to give explanation to that, but I can tell you something essential which will give you a holistic idea of what this is. Nature is the energy of God. And we saw that there are two types of natures. One is called inferior nature and one is called superior nature. Inferior nature is gross matter, earth, water, fire, air, ether. And superior nature is the Atma or the spirit soul. So both these natures are essentially energies of God. Both these natures are energies of God. And God can manipulate different energies for his needs according to the way he wants. Just like if somebody is a civil engineer, he knows how to use different earth elements combined together to produce different effects. You know, somebody can produce brick using rammed earth technology. Somebody can produce bricks using, you know, the burning traditional technology. Somebody can produce bricks using cement, concrete. Because the engineer knows to manipulate matter to his needs. So similarly, God, who is the source of all these elements, naturally can easily manipulate all these elements to suit his needs. Right? And he's already doing it. Just imagine, if you just go to a horticulture area, just see the number of flowers, the colors of the flowers, the varieties of fragrances, the varieties of looks and feel. You can understand how much manipulation has already been done in nature. Right? So if God can do so much, why can't you do one more thing? Right? That's how we understand it. But in detail, we will discuss it tomorrow. But does it answer your question?
Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm so grateful to you all for being a little later here. We'll have dinner and then you can come back and sit here. We can continue discussions. If anybody has any questions,